Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Whose phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
The list of Irish Rugby World Cup bogeymen is a long one, stretching all the way back to Australia's Brett Papworth in 1987. Hat tip to
Papworth.
Simon Hick for that one. Michael Laine in 91, I can remember him. Jonah Lomu running over us in 95. Our own 15-man line-out against Argentina in Lawns 99. 2003, it was the silky hands of Imanol Haranordicky. 2007, take your pick, bogeymen everywhere. 2011, Dan Lydiate chop-tackling our back row into oblivion. 2015, Juan Imhoff dancing around our soft defence out wide.
I was there, Ron.
And to that extensive list.
Sitting beside me.
Could have reached out and patted him on the back if I had any inclination to do
or
so.
Or boot him up the arse. Would have been perhaps the more picky.
When you were as close as many of the Irish defenders that day to laying a glove on Juan Imhoff.
A good bit closer. He ran towards me. So he ran away from those lads.
To that extensive list, you can add one more bogeyman. Our impending exit from the 2019 World Cup will be remembered for Typhoon Haggibus. Welcome to Monday's podcast. Hi, Murph. Hi, Ken.
Hello there, Roland.
Not to be confused with the Scottish word haggis. Haggibus means velocity, and it's due to hit Fukuoka this weekend, threatening the match against Samoa on Saturday morning. In the event of a postponement, the game will be registered as a 0-0 draw. That'd leave Scotland and Japan to carve out a result together on Sunday and send poor old Ireland packing from the tournament. I'm told this postponement will not happen. Something about a contingency plan, playing the match on Sunday in the same stadium as Japan-Russia. I just don't know. I can't trust all that. Weird things happen to Ireland in World Cups.
Diego Alvarez!
And this could be the weirdest yet. We draw nil all with
this is
Samoa.
This is definitely an escalation, I think.
This is an escalation. I can't surely happen.
Argentina just got a little too good for it to be humiliating for us to be knocked out of a World Cup by them.
Mm.
So we've had to get creative. And this is the best that World Rugby can come up with.
Yeah, nil all
a
draw.
A freak weather event. I mean, you know, quite frankly, do we deserve it? At this stage, do we deserve to be knocked out of this World Cup by a typhoon?
This is a load of nonsense. Hmm? This is clearly not going to happen.
Oh, here's Frano now. Go on, Ken.
I'm not saying that the weather, the storm isn't going to happen in the way that I have been guilty of doing before. I'm saying it's clearly not going to happen to a tier one nation rugby. That's not how rugby works. It's a case of there's a golden circle in rugby. It's called tier one. We're in it.
Well,
and it's going to take a lot more than some typhoon.
Well, Scotland are in it too, Ken, and they might just be the beneficiaries of this postponement. Scotland are still tier one before you have a pop at them.
they're on the way.
Yeah, I know it's not going to happen, Ken. I just wanted to mention the typhoon.
Why are people pretending this is a thing, like that's going to happen?
Our match could get switched to a different day and a different venue,
which
is a talking point, I think.
No, reasonable.
Japan got their bonus point with the last play of the game against Samoa, which is not necessarily good news for us. Certainly not good news for our friends, the jocks there across the water. Murph, permutation man, I'm still seeing some loose talk that Ireland just needs to win against Samoa and they'd be sure of going through.
No.
Is this true, permutation man?
Yes, Owen, I've heard people saying that we don't need a bonus point as well. And that makes me sad, Owen. For shame on those people, because we still very much need a bonus point against Samoa. Because if Scotland beat Russia with a bonus point on Wednesday and then beat Japan with a bonus point on Wednesday, that means they're on 15. We fail to score 4 tries, but beat Samoa, we're on 15. And if Japan get a losing bonus point, then they're on 15. So, How do you decide who comes the two out of three there when we all finish on 15 points?
I think Permutation Man has an answer to that question.
Well, it goes to points difference. Scotland, keep in mind they have Russia to play, beat Russia by 40-odd points. That means basically we're all pretty much on the same scoring difference. If they beat Japan...
Sorry, we're on plus 52, Scotland are on plus 10 at the moment.
Plus 10 at the moment. Remember, we played terribly against Russia, still beat them by 35 points to nil. So if they win by 40-odd, Japan are on plus 46. We'll all be in the same general ballpark. If Scotland beat Japan, then that means that they will have a better scoring average than Japan. Mm-hmm. And if Scotland finish top of this mini table on points difference, then to decide second place, it goes to results between Ireland and Japan. And guess what? Japan beat Ireland, which means that we would be on the plane home if we don't get that bonus point against Samoa. So
they will, at a minimum, clean out half of our squad.
We're going to get to all of that. We're going to get to all of that with Gerry Thorney in a few minutes. After we talk athletics, not a great week for the sport, let's be honest. Ridiculously poor turnout for a lot of the World Championships, which were held in Doha. The women's marathon was run in the middle of the night to avoid the worst of the heat, and they still had to run in horrendous conditions. And in the middle of it all, Alberto Salazar, coach to a number of the athletes competing at the Games, was banned for 4 years for doping violations. Salazar was found by an arbitration panel, found by by USADA, to have trafficked testosterone to athletes, administered a prohibited IV infusion, and also tampered or attempted to tamper with doping control processes. All of which made Saturday night somewhat uncomfortable viewing as one of his athletes, Sifan Hassan, romped to victory in the 1500 metres in a championship record time. This is after winning the 10,000 metres earlier in the championship. I know on the face of it, it sounds like winning a couple of races, that happens quite a lot. Surely people always do these doubles. Well, no, they might do the 5,000 and 10,000 or something along those lines. It's the first time ever that an athlete has done the 1500, 10,000 metres double in the same World or Olympic Games. That's either male or female. No athlete has ever done that in the same games before. So, I don't know, set your eyebrows to raised. That's the position mine were in when I was watching this. In fairness, though, to the athlete herself, she didn't exactly dodge the issue post-race. Here she is talking to the BBC.
I was just so angry and I couldn't talk to anyone. I just ran all out and I just wanted people so that hard workers can beat everything, can be better than everything.
When you say you were so angry and upset, is it because of what happened with your coach? Is that what made you so angry to run that time?
Yeah, it's like that's what made me angry. I have been clean all my life. I work hard. I'm actually no emotional person, but it makes me so mad when people... I have been in top almost 5 months. How can I do the things that so hard?
So there you go. And as cynical as I sometimes feel about athletics, when somebody confronts it head on like that and speaks so emotionally, I waver. I like to dream that maybe everything is okay with the world. But then Michael Johnson immediately put my feet back on the ground.
I understand her anger and I get that. But yes, that is a question that she's going to have to get prepared for. She made the decision to go to the Oregon Project. At the time that she went, Salazar was under investigation. I think many people thought that this investigation was going to go nowhere. And it stalled for quite some time, and now it's come back out. And I think maybe she thought, well, it's okay to go there. This is going nowhere. But it did go somewhere, and he is now banned. And she has to realize, and any athlete in that organization has to realize that that is going to be attached to them. They're going to have to answer these questions. And getting angry, you could be angry because, yes, people say all kinds of things on social media. This is the same exact situation that Christian Coleman was dealing with. And he got angry that people immediately said, well, you're a drug cheat because you had three missed whereabouts. And they're going to say, I'm sure they're saying Sifan Hassan is a drug cheat because you were with Alberto Salazar. I've already seen that. People in this sport, fans of this sport, are so sick and tired of drug cheats in the sport. They have had it. They have zero tolerance at this point. So if you are associated with a coach that is banned, if you miss your whereabouts filings, if you test positive or have any sort of connection to anything dealing with doping, they are done with you. And that's just the way that it is. And these athletes have to understand that. Now, if you are clean and you want to prove to them that you're clean, you're not going to get that done by being angry and going out and saying, I ran because I was angry and I want to prove to everyone I'm clean. Running fast, actually, if you've been under some kind of doping cloud, doesn't actually make you clean. You know, it doesn't prove to people that you're clean. They're going to say, yeah, see, that's what I mean. So you have to actually come clean to them about what you've been doing. You have to say, hey, I hold up my hand and I will be tested and wherever. You have to say, I understand why people are angry. I understand why people have these accusations against me, and then appeal to them that you're clean and that you support clean sport, and then go about your business. But showing that anger is not going to get you anywhere, and these athletes have to realize that.
Michael Johnson there with views that are a little bit at odds with what his BBC colleague Paula Radcliffe had said earlier in the week. We'll play a little bit of Paula for you later on. More to the point, we're going to talk to the man who set this whole Salazar investigation in motion, effectively Mark Daly, who put together the documentary for BBC Panorama that highlighted what Salazar was up to at the Nike Oregon project. Mark Daly on the show today. Simon, who the hell is Brett Papworth? Ah, never mind, more important things to worry about now. Things like this.
Up because there's an incredible gun off here.
Yeah, my apartment's going to be stacked full of lads.
Probably 10 lads coming over
For the whole thing, so it's going to be absolute carnage. It's going to be absolute carnage.
Absolute carnage.
It's going to be absolute carnage.
Absolute carnage. We're stacked full of lads. We're going to be 10 lads coming
absolute
over.
Carnage.
Simon, I don't know what you're doing toweling off there. Keep that top off and hit that bong one more time.
Let's go to Jerry Thorney in Japan now. Jerry, what's all this I'm hearing about a typhoon on the way? Should we be worried?
Yeah, we've had these warnings before. It is Japan's rainy season. World Rugby decided they would hold the World Cup in their wisdom in Japan's rainy season. The 19th typhoon of the season, Storm Hagibis, is due to hit the island of Kyushu and its capital of Fukuoka here on Saturday and Sunday, which, of course, where Ireland are based and where Ireland are playing, supposed to be playing Samoa on Saturday. So the only thing I would say is that the forecasts hereabouts are very, very changeable. Greg Feek warned us of this. Like, you can't really take a huge amount of cognizance of a forecast a week out or 5 days or 6 days out because it can change. If you remember, all sorts of gloomy weather forecasts were around the place for Ireland's opening game against Scotland and indeed the Springboks against the All Blacks. And the first game, the latter one between the two Super Southern Hemisphere powers, wasn't affected at all. And the rain only arrived and wasn't that desperate for the second half of Ireland's and Scotland's game. So it's very much up in the air to whether this typhoon is going to hit this island or not.
I hear that if it does, if there's a danger of it hitting, the call has to be made 48 hours before kickoff. Which will be Thursday morning, Irish time. You know, worst comes to the worst, right? They'll find a way to play it. They're talking about maybe moving it to the Sunday, playing it in the stadium where Japan are playing Scotland before that game. So they will actually play the match. I don't think we have to worry too much about this nil-nil draw that's been posted as a default result. But, you know, with something like that, is that manageable from Ireland's point of view if it ends up being changed either the day or the venue or whatever? Not ideal, but would it be manageable?
It could not only be manageable, it might even be preferable. The surface here in Fukuoka, judging by the television pictures of the France-USA, I think, played there, and there was one other game there as well, and they look bad. The pitch looked the worst of the dozen. It's quite gluey, quite sticky, churns up a lot, it's been relayed. So if there were high winds and heavy rain about, that could make it a real slugfest with the Samoans, which is not what Ireland would want. So in some respects, while it would be terribly inconvenient, it might be the worst thing in the world if the game was moved. Like I said, though, we won't know that until Thursday. I would be surprised if they put it back a day. Maybe they will move the venue. I don't know. We'll see. They're being very coy. They're just saying they have World Rugby have robust contingency plans. They also say it would be inappropriate to hypothesise.
Hypothesising is what we're all about in the build-up to a game like this, Jerry. The Japan-Samoa game, obviously, and the end game of that is huge for them, potentially sticky for us now. We just need we need to get our bonus point now against Samoa to be sure of going through, whatever about topping the pool. But just on Japan, getting that result, we haven't actually talked to you really about the atmosphere around the tournament. I presume the win over Ireland has set things up nicely. How into the whole thing are they now, and how into it were they for the game against Samoa?
Everywhere you go, it's extraordinary, the change. Now, of course, you're not comparing like with like, because lots of things can get lost in the vastness of Tokyo, but certainly it seems as if the nation has just jumped aboard after that win over Ireland. It was a godsend for the organisers for the tournament after England going out in the pool stages 4 years ago. It's definitely better for the tournament if the hosts go all the way to the quarterfinals. That's the first time it happened 4 years ago. I went to a bar, an English bar, I think it was. You see, they don't really have a pub culture over here, so the pubs that they do have, the local pubs, would be very tiny little pubs. You know, there's some lovely little sea beans down laneways that, you know, six people would pack the place out. But so I went to an English bar because the fan zone The long queue to get inside wasn't nearly big enough. And a lot of tables reserved, and I knew all Japanese fans coming in after England's win over Argentina. And I know, talking to a few of them, they were only watching their second or third game of rugby in their lives. And it's definitely very much a new sport for a lot of this country, I think, you know, new fans. And that manifests itself in a way they kind of cheer on their team. It's like almost like an excitable school crowd, you know, for school's game. They cheer when the slightest promising situation or half break happens, and then they go really quiet in between, and then they pay assiduous attention to conversion and give that a loud cheer, almost as much as they do to a try. But they're wonderfully enthusiastic, and the atmosphere for that opening game against Ireland was astonishing. So I think it's going to be very tough for Scotland to beat them, because just the momentum they have now, they're like a bullet train. And of course, the Scots have to play Russia 4 days before, but nobody can complain about that, because you know, this is what happened to the Scots. This is what happened to Japan 4 years ago, when Japan only got a 4 day turnaround before they played Scotland, having beaten South Africa.
Jerry, what did you make of the end of that game when the ref called a crooked feed, when Samoa could have kicked it out? It's fed into some of the conspiracy theories that have hit Twitter and social media over here. Has that reached the journalists in Japan?
I thought far more grievous was the decision by Jacko Piper to award a crooked feed. I'm pretty sure for the first time in this World Cup, and probably for the it could be the first time in years.
Yeah. I haven't seen one in about 20 years, Jerry, no matter how crooked it is.
I can't
just let
remember
it happen.
The last time just ridiculous. It's just so selective to come up with it in the 84th minute in overtime on the Samoan line, thereby give Japan a 5 minute scrum. Steve Jackson said he was bewildered by some of Jacko Piper's decisions, and I'd say that was uppermost amongst them. For as he pointed out also, the ensuing 5 meter scrum for Japan was every much a crooked feed. Like at this World Cup, it's been almost rugby league like. They're spinning the ball straight to the number 8's feet, never mind the second rows. It's just to come up with one then was just, that was extraordinary. And it has a huge impact on this pool, because that extra point leaves Japan firmly in the driving seat, and it's going to effectively mean, I think, that Scotland have to beat Russia with a bonus point and then go and beat Japan by more than 7, which is going to be a tall ask.
What do you think about the idea that the underdogs in general are getting a rough ride from the refs and officials?
That's probably a fair point. When you look at England and Piers Francis, how he can escape suspension, I don't quite understand when you compare what happened to the two Samoan players who suspended. Some of the second tier two nations can probably feel aggrieved. None more so, unfortunately, than the Samoans. Like Steve Jackson, they lost two players to suspensions for what were deemed yellow card offences at the time. Their Cardiff centre, Ray Lilo, and their hooker, Mutu Matu, they're both out of this game. They're out of the rest of the pool stages. They're feeling grievance over that. They're feeling bitter over the refereeing of Jacko Piper, and they've only got one group of people left on whom they can take out their frustration, and that's Ireland. And they ain't going to roll over and have their bellies tickled just because they're out of this tournament. They will want to leave a mark. God knows when they get to play a tier one country again. They've always been a brotherhood, a band of brothers, and I think it's just, yeah, I think that they can feel the most aggrieved, and they're probably going to set about being shown it against Ireland as well.
Jerry, that does worry me somewhat, and maybe the fears could be allayed a little bit with the return of Robbie Henshaw. I don't want to get bogged down in fitness chats that we have every week, but I mean, Henshaw is the one that we know has been injured and who was mooted. He was going to miss a lot of the pool. It does seem like he could be back. I don't know. We sometimes fall into the trap of when a player is out. We do this in football as well. They almost get overpraise, and it's like they'll be the solution to all our problems. But will he be the solution to at least one or two of our problems?
Well, he'd be like a fresh new signing, won't he? He's definitely playing. The fact that he was brought up in front of the media more or less said, yeah, he's good to go now. I think they gave him an extra few days just to make sure, because hamstrings can be tricky things. I didn't realise until I went through the records that, in actual fact, he missed the first two games in the last World Cup with a hamstring strain as well 4 years ago. And then came in for the Italy game, had an outstanding game against France, and then played in the quarterfinal against Argentina. And I think the fact that Joe Schmidt and the coaching staff were prepared to give Robbie Henshaw 3 matches to get himself right, and the strain that put on the midfield then, particularly as Bundiaki and Chris Farrell both missed games with concussion, and meant that Gary Ringrose had to go the full 83 games in a row. I think it shows you the esteem in which they hold Henshaw, and one would expect all things being equal for him to not only start this game, but if they get through a quarterfinal as well.
Well, maybe the most fixable of our problems, Jerry, is our line speed and our defence. And, you know, we had Owen Redden at the live show, and he was just gobsmacked at how we played against Japan. And people have been pointing out that Van der Vleer in particular is one of the few who's really racing up. But when others aren't coming up at the same speed as him, then there's a dogleg left and he's left sort of isolated. And then the outside backs of the opposition have loads of space in which to work and make decisions. But Robbie Henshaw could actually turn our defence into a weapon again. And he sort of has that aggression and enthusiasm and actual just pace. Like people say, oh, line speed, but there's only certain players who are really have that acceleration, like Owen Farrell, who can do it really well all the time.
Yeah, I would. I think Gary Ringrose defends the 13 channel very well like that. I mean, he goes down from 3 missed tackles a game, but in nearly every instance, because he's flying out of defence and kind of ushering the opposition ball carrier back inside his inside shoulder, anything where he's getting enveloped. So they're good missed tackles, if you know what I mean. I agree with you about the line speed. I thought that was very striking against Japan. That I thought Tyke Vernon was pushing up quite quick at times, and others just around him weren't at all. It was one example where Keen Healy was like 10, 15 yards away from him and about 5 yards behind him, and it would create quite a dog leg.
Yeah.
You're right about Josh Van der Vleer as well. I thought the line speed against Scotland was very good. But then again, of course, by the time Scotland started to play catch-up in the second half, it was raining. And actually, Scotland had better joy when they're running hard off 9 in that one time they did it. But I thought Ireland's line speed was quite good against Scotland. I thought it was really good in the last warm-up game against Wales. And I thought I was very surprised by the lack of line speed against Japan. Now, there's a few factors obviously at work here, you know, and that is the rapid-fire, quick ball that Japan were creating at ruck time meant it was just more difficult to get reset and push up quickly. And also, they got penalised 3 times for offsides, or 4 times, I think. 4 times for offside. And on 3 occasions, by World Rugby's own admittance, that was wrong. But when you're getting penalised for offside, if you like a trigger-happy bunch of officials for offside, I'd imagine it would take some of the desire to push up off the line or make you more hesitant in defence. Now, Arnie Farrell's been joking about pushing them back 15 or 10 metres a la rugby league, but maybe they might have to adjust by taking a step back and the referee starts doing that again and then still try and push up hard. In fairness, the defence actually has been one of the few features of the game. I know it got a little bit narrow for that Japan try, but like they've only conceded 22 points in one try, which is, it's not a bad foundation, really.
Keen Healy's the first player actually to come out. You mentioned him there, Jerry. He's the first player to come out and admit that he didn't feel his fitness was good enough against Japan, that his lungs were burning. And he's actually done extra sessions, which I would have assumed during a World Cup wouldn't happen or couldn't make enough of a difference. But did that surprise you that he said that? And is it sort of an explanation for what happened?
I don't know if it's an explanation. I don't know if nobody else has said that. What did surprise me? They definitely have struggled in the conditions a little bit. I thought they struggled physically against Japan. I thought it was more their execution and skills suffered as a result, but I thought they struggled physically against Japan. And it had almost echoes of Twickenham in the way that, you know, they started so well for 25 minutes and then couldn't sustain it. And apparently it was like no 10% more humid than it normally would be at this time of the year. It was 84% humidity for the Japanese game, which is, you know, that's going to be a struggle for most European sides, I think. I think particularly against the home side, who will benefit from those conditions the most. So I don't know is the honest answer. You caught me there. I just don't know if other players felt the same. I haven't heard anybody else say it.
Jerry, excellent stuff as always. Thanks, Emil.
Cheers, no worries.
Sport is a great thing, Pádraig, and especially hurling, our sport, the greatest sport that was ever played by any man. They're getting their reward today, mixed with this brilliant blend of youth, fire and enthusiasm, and so thrilled for them. Clareman, rivals of ours all our lives. But you know, the Cranberries go up around Crow Park. Dolores, one of their own, Pádraig. Magic, magic moment for them.
Well, it's a highly emotional scene.
Oh no, my stomach is burning here, lads. I tell you, oh dear.
Who's going to win it, guys?
Limerick.
Excuse me?
Dowling!
On your fire!
He didn't go to blow the onion bag after backing it in. He went to place it to the corner.
Limerick are on the brink of a historic breakthrough at Croke Park.
Limerick better wake up here because Galway are back in the game big time.
Cruised into the top of the net. Is there any end to the drama, Pádraig?
And Galway are within one of Limerick.
It's hard to watch.
Oh, man, I don't know what to say here.
Could he possibly... From 2-3 metres outside his own 45, the greatest sport that was ever played by any man.
That's a massive ask.
If you wanted one man in the history of hurling to hit it for you, you might want it to be Joe Kenning.
I think
The long wait is over.
How long has it again to wait?
Well, since 2007.
Well, 1973 is the last time they won. Well.
Limerick have it! Limerick are coming away with
it! Yeah!
If the rest of the world only knew about this sport, this is incredible.
Limerick have beaten Galway!
In summary, Jerry's not too worried about the typhoon, is worried about how fired up Samoa will be for this game. So we'll see what happens. And of course, we'll have plenty of coverage on the World Service during the week. We heard from Michael Johnson earlier on the questions athletes at the Nike Oregon Project will legitimately have to face in the wake of Alberto Salazar's four-year ban. That clip I played earlier, just in terms of the chronology, the race was on BBC and it was some other events took place. And a little while later, they played the Sifan Hassan interview after she'd won, a good bit after she'd won the 1500 metres. And then Johnson talked about the interview. During the race itself, it was interesting that neither Steve Cram nor Paula Radcliffe made any issue of the fact that Hassan was coached by a man who'd just been suspended from the sport for 4 years for doping violations, as they commentated on it. Radcliffe had spoken about Salazar when the news of the ban initially broke last week. Here's a bit of what she had to say on BBC's coverage that night.
He has been found guilty of overstepping that line. And we've all talked about in the past how Alberto in particular will push it right up to that line. Has been very, very conscious of trying to find out where the limits lie and how close he can push it to try and get those last little bits of gains to compete with what athletes that in his mind in other parts of the world are really cheating, and to see what he can do. And he's overstepped that. And Denise had a point earlier. He probably should hold his hands up and say, yeah, I did. I overstepped. The rules were broken. I will now take the punishment for that. But because no athletes have been sanctioned, have real anti-doping violations been transgressed by athletes? I don't think so. Otherwise, we would have seen athletes banned at this point.
Yes, this is the same Paula Radcliffe who once held up EPO cheats out, that sign in the stands at the 2001 World Championships in Canada. The same Paula Radcliffe who wrote in her book that everybody knows the tests are not guaranteed to expose the cheats. But anyway, that's where she is now with all of this. I want to talk to Mark Daly, who's been an interested spectator, I'm sure, as the Salazar controversy has unfolded over the course of these championships. His violations, Salazar's violations, that is, were uncovered during a USADA investigation sparked by the work that Mark did for BBC Panorama in exposing wrongdoing at the Nike Oregon Project. Mark, it's great to talk to you.
Hello there, how's it going?
It's going well, yeah. Can I just ask what your initial reaction was last week when you heard the news that Salazar was banned?
Lots of people thought this case had gone away. We knew it hadn't, and we knew that a decision was pending. What we didn't know was which way it was going to fall. So I was expecting a decision last week. But like everybody else, I had, and like USADA, like Nike, like Salazar, I had no idea which way it was going to fall. So when it did fall, what can I say? It was great to hear that the whistleblowers who had put so much on the line had been vindicated. It was good that our journalism had been vindicated, and that really that the truth was now out, and it had been agreed by an independent panel of arbitrators. So I was pleased.
I saw a report last week by BBC saying that that Nike had sent around a letter to their own staff saying that the panel did not find that Salazar or anyone in the Oregon Project administered any banned substances. What they say is it upheld three charges against Alberto, all of which were committed without an intent or effect to dope or cheat. What would you say to that interpretation of the hearing?
Yeah, well, that's the interpretation that the arbitrators came to. It's not the interpretation of USADA. Now, you have to remember, arbitrators are attempting to find some middle ground, and they are also duty-bound to stick hard and fast to what are doping violations. Now, you remember from our Panorama programme and from the case that USADA built, you know, what we uncovered was a culture at this project where the coach would be using potentially dangerous amounts of non-banned prescription drugs when there was no medical needs. So there was more to this case than what were violations and what were not. But just getting right to your point,
yeah,
the arbitrators accepted Salazar's explanation that the testosterone experiments that he was doing on his sons to find out how much it would take to test positive. I think that USADA were very surprised at how credible sound that explanation. I think they were disappointed that also they didn't find in their favour on the grounds that Salazar may have breached rules in giving infusions to athletes. The phrase I've heard quite often this week is that it feels a little bit like getting Al Capone on tax evasion. Now, that's not my phrase, but that's a phrase quite often. And I think that USADA, and I think that many athletes in the sport will be pleased that this has come to come to an end. But we know there's going to be appeals further down the road to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. But this is the most famous athletics coach in the sport. He and his doctor have been, or the Nike doctor he was using, have been banned for 4 years. It's quite a seismic event.
Yeah, it really is. And while the case is at an end, appeal pending, the ramifications certainly aren't. And we saw some of those ramifications play out in Doha, notably with Sifan Hassan winning on Saturday night, completing her double, and then very strenuously denying any wrongdoing and getting very emotional in doing so. Do you have any sympathy at all for her, for an athlete who hasn't tested positive, but everybody is making assumptions based on her coach?
I've got every sympathy with athletes who have not been found to have cheated. And, there have been no allegations made against Sifan Hassan. But I think the issues at play here is not about whether or not she cheated. It's about her judgment. Now, she joined the Oregon Project knowing full well Salazar was under investigation. Panorama had already been broadcast. You know, Panorama alleged that he had cheated, that he was testing banned steroids on his sons. There was enough information out there for athletes to make an informed choice about whether or not to go to or stay with this particular coach. And that's a decision that Hassan is having to answer questions on. And, you know, many will think quite rightly so.
I've been quite interested in the reaction in the athletics world to all this, Mark, and to the very many questions that have been raised. I don't know what you've made of it, in particular the BBC analysis. Paula Radcliffe has been getting hammered left, right and centre for saying, essentially her argument was, look, Salazar knew other people were cheating. He was just looking for the line and he's overstepped that line, so that's not good. But have real anti-doping rules been transgressed by athletes? I don't think so. Otherwise, we would have seen athletes banned at this point. Do you think Radcliffe is minimising the seriousness of what's happened here?
I don't know how much more serious a four-year ban for the world's most famous athletics coach it needs to be. It is the most significant doping ban in recent years for a coach, for a well-known coach. And I think to disregard the significance of this would be unwise.
The argument she's making is that USADA should be spending less time on going after a coach and more of the resources on testing athletes, and the implication being that's how you get results.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you remember from my Panorama programme, as well as investigate the Nike Oregon project, I also investigated the efficacy of the athlete's biological passport.
I remember it well. It was a fascinating one, Mark.
And I'm just thanks very much. I'm just an amateur cyclist working from the internet, and I managed to drive a coach and horses through the athlete's biological passport without any scientific oversight. Yeah. And I was doping for with EPO for 7 weeks, 3 injections a week, whilst being tested every single week, and I didn't raise a red flag. So, you know, testing is crucial, but it's not the be-all and end-all, and athletes know how to get around it. I mean, how many times have we heard the famous phrase, I've never tested positive, from athletes who have been exposed as cheats? The new frontier of investigating these sorts of cases is whistleblowers. It's whistleblower testimony. And that's how Armstrong was caught. That's how Salazar has been caught. And so, just getting back to your point about the reason, you know, the amount of resources spent on this case. I mean, I think USADA would say, and I'm not a spokesman for them, but I know a little bit about how much time and resource had to go into this case as a direct result of the ferocity with which Salazar and Dr. Jeffrey Brown fought this case, backed by the lawyers paid for Nike. And so, I mean, you had a claim that the case would have been much quicker, much more straightforward, if Nike lawyers hadn't obfuscated their way through this case. So, and I think if you, and the WADA rules are there for a reason, and, you know, nobody has proven that Alberto Salazar was injecting his athletes with steroids or EPO, but what they have proven are three serious transgressions, and rules are rules, and he's banned for 4 years. And, you know, I would hope that people in athletics, particularly experienced people within athletics, would welcome such a ban for a coach who wasn't playing by the rules.
Well, Steve Cram, 4 years ago, referred to this whole thing as a witch hunt. I talked about Paula Radcliffe there. Is it frustrating for you, as somebody who exposed the wrongdoing on a BBC Panorama documentary, to, I don't want to put words in your mouth here, but to see his wrongdoing being minimised potentially by some of the analysis on the station during major championships?
Look, I'm not going to get into a fight about what other BBC staff have said about my journalism. I think the journalism stands or falls on its own merits. It's journalism that ended up in a USADA investigation, which has resulted in this four-year ban. And, you know, everybody, including Steve Cram and Paula Radcliffe and Seb Coe, they're all entitled to their opinion.
The hold that Nike has in this sport seems very strong. I mean, I saw Cara Goucher today, who spoke in your documentary. And just to remind, like, some of the details, you know, Salazar had encouraged her to take thyroid medication to help her lose weight after giving birth and all this kind of stuff. She says the Nike Oregon project should be shut down and that all athlete samples should be retested. Would you go along with that, or does anything else need to be done from this point, or are you comfortable that Salazar essentially has been bagged and that's that?
Look, I mean, I'm not a commentator I'm an investigator, and so my job is to find the evidence to put these things into the public domain. I mean, it's kind of for others to express their opinions on what should happen to the Oregon Project or to its athletes, and that's why it's crucial that people like Cara Goucher and Steve Magnus have their say. But look, there's no doubt about it. There has been a cloud over this project for years, and that cloud has only thickened with the news that Salazar has been confirmed as a cheat, and I expect that will have further ramifications. The Athletics Integrity Unit of the IAAF is looking at the judgments very carefully. The athletes themselves are not able to have any contact with the coach. Alberto Salazar, to an extent, was the Nike Oregon project. So one must assume that there are some decisions to be made about how that group goes forward. I mean, there's a dozen of the world's best athletes currently there. And the majority of them, there has never been any allegations. So I don't know what the future holds for the Oregon Project. And I guess that's up to Mark Parker and Phil Knight to decide.
Mark Daly, listen, great to talk to you. Great work. And thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks very much. All the best.
Bob sweeps side to side, up, down, in, out, scores left hand. There's 10 seconds to go. McGuigan on a rope, off the ropes, takes a left to the body, but the champion has no venom left. As McGuigan goes for the big finish, catches him with the right hand, it's all over! It's all over! They're going for silver, they're going for bronze. John Tracy is 100 metres to go. In the past, Ireland have won bronze medals. John Caldwell, Freddie Gilroy, Sox Byrne, Jim McCourtney, Russell. They've won golds, Pat O'Callaghan twice, Bob Tizzle, Ron Delaney. They've won silvers with John McNally, Fred Teague, Wilkinson. And for the 13th time, an Irish medal goes to John Tracy. The crowd stands for the Irishman from Villierstown and Waterford. The little man with the great heart.
If it's the blue one, it's the Cuban. If it's the red one, it's the Irishman. The Cuban did some very good work on the inside. And Michael Carruth is the champion of the Olympic Games. Michael Carruth is the champion, the champion, the champion.
Gentlemen, I'm in the ring here. And it's a joyous moment.
Barry McGuigan, champion of the world.
Oh, Jimmy, Jesus. A dream come true.
Barry, it's a long time since there was supposed to be in the National Stadium.
Yeah. Hello, Ireland! Hello!
We love you. Well done, Barry. That's it. Barry McGuigan being swept away. Your commentator with him from QPR's football ground. Ladies and gentlemen, I leave you with the words. Barry McGuigan is champion of the world.
I know this story is not complete without Mo Farah's statement. You guys want to know where Mo Farah is on his ex-coach?
Always.
I'm relieved that USADA has, after 4 years, completed their investigation into Alberto Salazar. I left the Nike Argan project in 2017. But as I've always said, I have no tolerance for anyone who breaks the rules across the line. A ruling has been made, and I'm glad there has finally been a conclusion. So, essentially, in two or three different ways, he says he's glad that this has ended. So there you go.
Sebastian Coe is something else, isn't he?
What do you want to say about Coe?
I've just seen a few of his quotes. I mean, was he the genius who decided that this World Championship should happen in Qatar in an empty stadium?
I'm sure there's a committee, Ken, or whatever it might be, as is
but
usually
the one overseeing it, yes.
You don't know Joanne.
He pinned a medal on the Emir of Qatar the other day as well for his services to sport.
Do you want to hear the good news?
Yeah, go on.
Kieran McGeehan, 10th place in the 1500 metres final, personal best, and also probably it's good news that she's miles behind the likes of Hassan in that same race there. Here she is post-race with talking to David Gillick, I believe.
Came into this competition probably ranked 14th or 16th, I think. Came 10th in the world. That's not a bad place for a wee girl from Portaferry. So, I'm delighted. It shows me I have a lot of work to do to be where I want to be. First place is my goal in life, and I think everybody can see I'm a different athlete now, and it's clear to see and just how much I'm enjoying it. I am so nervous out there, but I come off and I don't want to have any sad faces coming off a track. Listen, we do it because we absolutely love it. I'm just so grateful. I'm grateful to be able to wear this vest, to be able to represent my country, my hometown, my county, and my team in Manchester.
Just saying, things are going well for Richie Sadler's guests on the player's chair. Matt Doherty flying it for Wolves, Kieran McGeehan now qualifying for a World
Final. Made the difference for Wolves,
final.
Of course, as we've discussed.
Made the difference for Wolves by allowing Traore to move further forward and score the two goals that won the game for them against Manchester City. Richie Sadler, speaking of the player's chair, is going to be launching his book tonight, Recovering. We're going to be at that event. We're going to be interviewing Richie, and we're going to be playing that for you tomorrow. I know this is the part where you normally think I'm giving you the hard sell on the World Service for non-members, but I'm feeling good. I'm feeling happy about life. I say we open this to everybody. You can all listen to that interview tomorrow. Can't say fairer than that.
Well done.
I will record an ad later in the week to give you the hard sell at that point. So we'll.
Don't worry about that.
you're not going to wait the week. No. Thanks so much, Murph. Thanks so much, Ken.
Thank you all.
Well done.
Bye-bye.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.